Between the Lines
with Sarah McInerney.
This is News Talk.
Good morning, I'm Sarah McInerney and welcome to Between the Lines. Every Saturday morning on this programme we take a closer look at some of the main stories and issues of the week. And we have lots to come for you over the next hour. Naomi McElroy will be joining us as usual, and this week she's going to be talking to us about Christine Keeler, who died this week. We'll be discussing with her the story of Christine Keeler, the reaction to a big scandal that she was involved in the 1960s, and whether indeed anything has changed since then. But to start, we're joined this morning by Minister for Education and Skills, Richard Bruton. There's been a very busy week of announcements in the education sector this week, which we're going to get to with the Minister, but also obviously a very busy week in terms of Brexit, Minister, and the Irish question, and a massive breakthrough yesterday. We weren't sure whether or not it was going to happen. It looked like maybe it might be pushed to the deadline of Sunday night, but no, we got it on Friday morning, and a lot of celebration in Republic of Ireland circles and from the Irish government indeed, but also questions as to whether or not it might be a bit premature to celebrate. Do you have any concerns that what was agreed and what is now going to be going to the European Council next week could be seen as a fudge?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you have to bear in mind that this is phase one of a negotiation and there are another 2 years to go. And the detailed negotiations of the relationship between the UK and the EU has still to be fully worked out. But what we've achieved at phase one is a commitment that even if things go wrong in phase two, there are guarantees around the border, around the customs union, around the single market north in the island of Ireland. I think that's really important. I think it narrows down the areas where things could potentially get difficult for Irish business. It copper fastens the political agreement. It gives citizens in the north rights as European citizens. It copper fastens the common travel area. So an awful lot has been achieved in this first phase. But of course, there are uncertainties in the rest of the working out of the British extraction from the European Union. And we know that.
Yeah, because I saw Nick Clegg, the Lib Dems MP, tweeting about this, and he was saying, yes, as you said, he said it's game, set and match for the money issue and the bill that Britain is going to have to pay. It's game, set and match for the issue of freedom of movement and EU citizens. But he says it's not game, set and match on the border. He says there's a fudge here on the border, that it's still a bit uncertain and there's irreconcilables in what is in the document. That it's very hard to see how what is in the document can work in practice.
I don't think that's fair. I mean, if you read the document, it's very clear that the British are making a commitment that if there's no agreed solution, if everything goes pear-shaped in their negotiation with the EU, that we will still have the rules of the internal market, the full alignment between North and South, that they will underpin the North-South's all-island economy. I think that's a really important statement. It means that there will never be a hard border. It means that people doing business North and South can continue to trade freely. And that's not not good news story just for those in the Republic. It's equally good news story for those in the north doing business. So I think there are certain gains. Now, of course, other things can go wrong. A lot of our businesses trade east-west, and those have to be, where we are part of the European Union, those will have to be worked out in the next phase. But I think a very important objective has been achieved here. And I think it's good for everyone. It's not this isn't a win of one side over another.
That's not how it's being portrayed in some media circles, but fair enough. You mentioned the hard border there, and one commentator, Cliff Taylor, pointing out in the Irish Times yesterday that there's no definition of what a hard border means. So while we may have one interpretation of what a hard border means, the British government may have quite another interpretation of what it means. So we may think that everything continues exactly as normal. They may think that maybe it means that, you know, there's not lengthy customs queues.
Well, I think you read the text, the United Kingdom, this is in the absence of agreed solutions, the United Kingdom will maintain full alignment with those rules of the internal market and the customs union, which now or in the future support North-South cooperation, the all-Ireland economy and protection of the 1998 agreement. Now that's pretty categorical. statement, full alignment with the rules of the internal market and the customs union. Now, that is something that clearly is what people sought, and it means there will not be need for barriers because there will be full alignment within the customs union and in the internal market. So I think that is a very categorical statement. Of course, Britain and we want to see a very successful trade agreement established between the EU and the UK, and the details of that remain to be worked out, and that will be of huge importance to Irish businesses, many of whom trade very heavily in the UK. But I think, you know, as a phase one, the phase one part, we have copper fastened what we sought to copper fasten in phase one, and now we've to move on to the next phase. And I think it gives people greater certainty. I mean, I've just come from discussing apprenticeships and the opportunities that apprenticeships offer. We're getting thousands of businesses to engage now in building apprenticeships for the future. They now have a greater certainty of the arena in which they're planning their strategies for the future. I think that, you know, this has given that greater certainty and confidence.
Does it mean that no matter what happens now, we are heading for a softer Brexit, that there can't be this hard Brexit that we were all afraid of a couple of months ago, or indeed even a week ago?
Well, I think there's a greater realisation that if Britain is to achieve the sort of free trade agreement that it wants with the European Union, that there's going to have to be very substantial alignment of the way they do their business. Now, it's not saying it's going to be 100% between the UK and the EU, but I think there is a realisation that Britain wants a free trade agreement with the EU. It's really important to their business. I mean, a lot of what's been happening in recent weeks has been, you know, the voice of business has been saying how important the European Union is to British business. And I think that has coloured the discussion. And I think you don't hear as much of the sort of jingoistic type of commentary that was coming from the political system during the Brexit campaign. It's down to, you know, hard nosed discussion. And I think, you know, at the end, economics does matter. And, you know, politicians have to respect that people's livelihoods depend on free access to markets where they've built up a custom and a profile.
OK, just final question this before we move on to some of the education things that you've been announcing this week. The Taoiseach said yesterday that he believes this agreement is bulletproof. And yet, right in the middle of the agreement, there is a sentence which suggests it's not bulletproof, which is the caveat that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed.
Well, I think what the British have said, that in the events of no agreed solution, this will still happen. So that does mean that even if nothing is agreed, we still have this element. So I think that is a really important element. Of course, there are other elements like the financial element. They will want to retain their right if everything breaks down, that they will want to reopen the financial peace. That's what they're saying. But I think people are now moving to the second phase, and I think something of the sort of dancing around the edges, positioning for, you know, trying to get the best position before negotiations start. We're out of that phase now. I think the political challenges are there, but the political atmosphere will be much more agreeable, I think, to finding solutions.
Right. Well, we'll see about that, because again, some British reporters reporting that British officials, British government officials, are saying it's going to be fireworks in the next phase, and that's when they're going to get what they want. But
well, it'll be fireworks for officials, where they'll be working in great detail around the width of tyres or things like that. But you know, I think we're moving into the real solid negotiation about elements of a trade agreement. I think both sides have a mutual interest in getting an outcome here. It's not that one side wants a different outcome from others. It's just a quite to reconcile what that means has to be worked out.
All right. I want to talk to you about STEM, because you have announced that you want to increase by 20% the total number of students taking chemistry, physics, technology and engineering for the Leaving Cert, and also that you want to increase by 40% the number of girls or females also taking STEM subjects for the Leaving Cert. How do you propose to do that?
Well, right across a range, we're going to reform the curriculum. We're going to invest in hard terms. We want to improve the facilities in schools that offer science. We want to see more girls in particular participate in the out-of-school science avenues, these young scientists, the SciFest, the Coder Dojo, because they have been proven to be the gateway to girls in particular selecting science subjects. So we want to make the curriculum more exciting. We want to make it easier for people to come in. We will be developing a stronger teacher base, if you like. We will be attracting new people into teaching from physics, chemistry, the STEM areas. We will be investing in the upskilling of those who are already there so that science can be taught in really exciting ways. Digital technology has actually transformed the way all education happens, but particularly in science, it's changing it.
So when you say, just to clarify, when you say investing in resources for the classrooms, for example, are you talking about the science labs just having better technology in the science labs that people can work with their hands? And
yeah, that will be a part of it. We will want to improve the technology. We will want to improve the labs. We'll want to improve the way science is taught. The Leaving Certificate, as you know, have brought in a new way of teaching science at junior cycle, which is much more exciting. It includes portfolios of achievement, of experiments, of things that people have done, work that they've done collaboratively with other students. That, we believe, will greatly enhance the attraction of science. Obviously, we need to move now, and the NCCA is looking at the Leaving Certificate and how can we have assessment that engages people. But there's also, clearly, we want to make sure that girls in our school particularly, but also boys and girls, know the exciting career paths that are available.
All right, so 40% target of increase of females looking at these subjects is very ambitious. I'm not sure making science a bit more exciting is going to do that. I mean, how exactly do you get that sort of increase in female participation?
Well, at the moment, only one in six, less than one in six girls take physics or chemistry. So I think one proven area is that if you get people to participate in science projects.
So how do you do that?
Well, we will support young scientists. We'll support SciFest, which is a regional. It's a bit like the young entrepreneur competition that I had in my last job. It's very like SciFest is structured like that. It is a county level, at regional level, and at national level. I think if we can get more people participating in that, there is almost an automatic knock on to subject choice.
So what
choice.
Is it, going into schools and targeting girls, or going into girls' schools?
Going
and
into schools.
Them?
See, a lot of schools don't participate in these programmes.
Right.
So we have to reach out to schools that don't participate and engage with them. And I think there's a great enthusiasm among those who run these competitions to see a broader base of schools getting involved. And we can also introduce that to give it recognition in, for example, the junior cycle, that a project that you did for young scientists or SciFest becomes an element of your portfolio. And increasingly, employers, when they look at someone's coming to them for a job, they're much more interested not just in your Leaving Cert, but the projects you did, the sort of things that shaped your education career. And these sort of competitions and projects, that's what differentiates a person, and they can do that and have it recognised in the junior cycle. Those are really important elements.
All right, you mentioned teachers as well, and the quality of teachers, the ability of teachers, the amount of teachers being able to teach these subjects. And yet, recent figures showed that there's only six physics teachers in training, graduates in training at the moment. I mean, the teachers aren't there.
Well, no, that's not true. 41 physics teachers registered for the first time last year. So there is a flow. There's about over 1,000 physics teachers, which is the tightest area in the system, who are registered.
There's a shortage. You accept there's a shortage?
There is a shortage, but it's not that we're without physics teachers, but we need more. And I suppose you have to look at, in the last 2 years, at second level, we've recruited over 3,000 extra teachers, and we've fulfilled all of those areas. So there isn't a shortage of teachers overall, but there are certain pinch points like physics, chemistry, and some of the STEM subjects. So we're looking at a number of initiatives that can be taken there. We're evaluating them. One would be simply subsidising people who do these subjects to do a master's in education and move into teaching.
So pay for their master's for them, or some of it.
Pay for some of it. That's one route. Another is being more discerning of those who go into teacher training, that you would ensure that there is a quota for subjects where there is scarcity, be it language, physics, chemistry or STEM, so that you would be more discerning as to who is recruited into teaching. We have too many doing subjects like geography and so on compared to what we need. So I think there's a number of ways in which we can look at it. Then you can look at people who already have qualifications in these spheres who might be attracted back into education. So we're looking at a number of initiatives, and even people who are already in their study, we could attract them into doing some of these subjects where we have a gap.
Well, you can certainly try, but teaching groups are saying that part of the reason for you having this problem in terms of attracting people in these subject areas is because of the two-tier pay system that still exists and because of the problem of getting permanent jobs in teaching. And that is a continuing sore, isn't it, in the education sector for teaching staff, that teachers are teaching alongside other people who have gone through exactly the same process as them and they're getting paid substantially less or substantially more, whatever it may be, than them?
Well, there's 2 points to make about that. Firstly, we have not had difficulty in recruiting either 3,000 extra teachers at second level or at primary level. We have fulfilled that. Now, there are pinch points in particular areas. The second thing is, you know, I was able to sit down with the three teachers' unions and negotiate an improvement under Lansdowne Road that delivered 75% of the gap. So, you know, a newly graduating teacher next January will be on 36,000. So that is an attractive salary. Now, of course, the trade unions want to see...
It's not that attractive, though, is it? I mean, we know that many, many teachers are going to Dubai, for example, to teach there to try and increase their salary or to try and save, for example, for a house here. I mean, anecdotally, you'll hear a lot of teachers moving out of the capital because they can't afford to live in the capital on their salary. Because it may be an attractive enough salary to come in, maybe at a starting level, but the gradient going upwards is very slow.
Well, it's not. The increment is 1,000 per year, every year. So they do go up on an increment. Now, I'm not denying, of course, that the trade unions do want to negotiate the remaining 25%. And that's something that the teachers' unions are very keen to do. And as you know, Pascal Donoghue has put a process into the present pay agreement that involves the discussion of how that might be done. That process has already started. The teachers' unions are engaged in it. So I fully recognise that there is, if you like, an outstanding issue on the teaching agenda, and they want to pursue this, and there is a process through which they're pursuing it. But in terms of its knockback onto education, you know, we still are working to recruit, to improve our education system. And as you saw earlier in this week, you know, we have now, we're the best country in Europe for the literacy, the reading standards of our 10-year-olds. Equally, we're best for mathematics for our 10-year-olds. We're the best at retaining, all bar one country, at retaining children in the education system to complete. We're the best at recruiting to the third level. So, you know, we have a very strong education system, and we value teachers because teachers are the key that make a difference. So while there's pay issues, and I recognise they have to be managed, you know, we are trying to work with teachers and with the system, which is performing to a very high level.
On that point of recruiting to the third level, are we doing that too well, Minister, do you think? Because as you said, you were yesterday launching 26 new apprenticeships. And yet the take-up of apprenticeships in this country is very, very low. I think it was something like 2% were the figures in May that I saw in one report. Everybody in the middle class thinks we should be sending our kids to college, and that's the mindset. How do you break that mindset?
Well, first of all, I'd say the figures are a lot better than you say. 4,500 young people took up apprenticeships this year. So that compares with what, about 40,000 who are going to third level.
So it's not 10%, is it?
It's 10%.
Okay. Sorry, it's an Irish Times report from May that I'm referencing.
Yeah, and our ambition is to build that to 9,000, and we're ramping that up. During the week, we announced that there's 26 new apprenticeships in the second round. So we will move from a situation where there were 25 apprenticeship options to where there's 78 apprenticeship options by 2020. That's a massive expansion of the range. Now, the attraction of apprenticeship to parents and students alike is that it is an earn as you learn model. So you actually have an employment contract, you're being paid from word go, you're not paying student fees, you're being paid and you learn in a very practical environment. I think you're right. you know, parents and employers have to recognise that we should have more than just 10%. We should be aiming for 20% going into apprenticeship as an interim target.
And do you think that's because we have this mindset, or there is this snobbery that apprenticeships are for people who aren't able for college?
Well, no, I think what happened was in the crash. Well, firstly, the range was too narrow. So we'd only 25 apprenticeships, too narrow a range. And when the crash came, they collapsed. So we went from maybe about 8,000 going into apprenticeships down to just little over 1,000. So that was a complete collapse. There simply weren't options. Now we're not just building up those traditional 25 areas, which are going really strongly, but we're going to have, you know, nearly 60 are now in the pipeline. 60 new areas where apprenticeships can be got are now in the pipeline at different stages of development. They'll be rolled out. We've had 11 will be in place this year, another 16 next year, and so on.
All right, so how do you increase that take up and convince people not to go to college though? Because again, another report in the last couple of months showing that the Irish are the most overqualified in Europe, that we have 60% of our young people are going to university, that's projected to go to 70%. There is still this idea that that's the route that you take. And obviously our universities are straining in terms of funding to try and cope with all these students. So we have this, as you are outlining it, very attractive apprenticeship option, but people aren't taking it up. So how do you get that to happen?
Well, there are 4,500 are taking it
all
up,
right,
and we're going
to
double that.
Okay,
so, well, I think it's by offering the attractive options like recruitment. Now there'll be an apprenticeship in recruitment. There'll be apprenticeships in biopharma. There'll be apprenticeships in farming, in equine, in horticulture.
Well, how do you convince people that that's as good an option as university?
But they've never had this option before. So now they suddenly have an option where they can earn from day one, get a really practical experience and qualification. And if they wish, at the end of that, they can go on and do a degree. Now, I think that's a very attractive path. And for example, I was recently down with Liebert, you know, the crane company in Germany. And they told me that in German companies, more of their CEOs are recruited from the apprenticeship stream than from their college graduates. And that's an example, because people need that practical, technical skill as well as the academic. And the apprenticeship allows you to combine the two.
So build it and they will come, is the idea?
I think we're not having difficulty filling out the apprenticeships. And the real challenge is to get enough employers creating coalitions to build this model. And it's great to see employers are up for it, because they know that their ability to attract and retain talent is the key to the success of their business. If they want to be in a position to handle Brexit or any other challenge that's sent their way, if they have that talent base and that flexibility, that innovative and creativity that apprenticeships offer, they will be able to respond to the challenges. So, you know, it's a really exciting thing. And I suppose both students and parents thinking of the future for their kids should recognise that this is a really attractive option. I'm not saying third level is great for people, but this is a really competitive option.
All right. I want to talk to you about languages as well, because another thing that you've been announcing recently is a roadmap to put Ireland in the top 10 countries in Europe for both teaching and learning of foreign languages. The idea of Mandarin Chinese as a Leaving Cert subject. And I'm just wondering how you plan to get there. What are you thinking, for example, bonus points to try and convince people to focus more on languages, or what exactly is it?
We're looking at bonus points for people who would go into degrees that incorporate languages. We want to see, like, a lot of people, 70,000 people do languages, 70% rather of Leaving Certificate people do a language. So that's a very high proportion. The trouble is it's too concentrated in French and not enough in the other areas. So we want to do two things. One is improve the proficiency in the language that are taken, but also have a greater diversity. So we're looking at, you know, new curricula, as you say, for Mandarin, but also for Portuguese, Polish and Lithuanian. We want to develop the languages of trade and the enterprise.
Why those? Why Polish and Lithuanian? Because I can understand Chinese from a jobs perspective, but it's not like we have a mass of Irish people moving to Poland or Lithuania.
No, but we have
a lot
of Polish people a lot of young people in our education system who speak Polish or Lithuanian
so
in the home.
For them.
It's cater for them. I mean, we have a diverse and student range. I was actually out in Cabra Convent, you know, Dominicans, where I was in school as an infant myself, and they were where we were launching this, and they spoke in nearly 20 languages were spoken at the start. Everything from languages of Africa, Russia, Lithuania, Eastern Europe, India, China. it was amazing to see the diversity that's in just that one school. So you know, that is a great strength, and we need to value that and allow them achieve curricular recognition in Ireland. And they are, you know, obviously a fantastic base for anyone who wants to trade in those countries. But we also need to recognise that we you know, the language, 90% of the growth of business in the future won't be in the European Union. It's going to be in Asia and elsewhere. We have to speak those languages. We have to bring in Arabic, Japanese, Chinese into our system and encourage people.
So do you intend to bring in those as well?
Those will be coming in. Now, obviously, they'll be coming in as well. There'll be short courses, as they're called, for either transition year pupils or junior cycle short courses where people can get a taster. We will look, you know, very much at third level. We want to deepen Erasmus, both deepen it and extend it. So we want to have a 50% increase in the number of students doing Erasmus. We have very small, only 4% of those who do higher ed actually have languages as part of their degree. It's really small for a trading economy, so we want to broaden that. And it, you know, I used to be in the previous job, jobs, and companies like Dairy Master, fantastic company in Kerry. They could do a lot more if they had technical people who had capacity in a language.
All right, and I can understand again from a, I suppose, an outward looking perspective why we were focusing on foreign languages. And yet, when I was looking at the details of the strategy, the one thing that struck me was the absence of Irish. And I know you wouldn't class Irish as a foreign language, obviously, but it does seem to me something that is way down the bottom of the list for Fine Gael and a Fine Gael-led government. Even, for example, the promotion of Josepha Madigan, who I think is a very bright, competent and able person in TD, but her promotion to the ministry of the Gaeltacht when she has, by her own admission, a very, very weak grasp on the language, I think speaks volumes, doesn't it, about this government's approach to the Irish language?
First of all, I'd say we're the first government ever to introduce a Gaeltacht strategy to protect and develop the language in the Gaeltacht. And we're now introducing a programme of immersion schools, and 96% of the secondary schools and 80% of the primary schools have signed up to an immersion model in which we will be investing additional teaching hours. We will create hubs for e-learning so that, you know, where there's scarcity of teachers that can teach in Irish, they can share their learning. We're investing very substantially in improving the language in the Gaeltacht. So we're the first government to actually do that. So I think that disputes your argument that we've some way downvaluing it. And I think it's really exciting. I was down in Rathcairn only last week, where we, 1 year on since the launch of that strategy, saw what a big take up was there. And those are really living communities where they commit to using Irish, and we will protect that language. I think you're wrong about Josepha too. Josepha has honours leaving certificate Irish. She spoke in Irish yesterday at the launch of Creative Ireland in our schools. You know, she is going to brush up her language, obviously.
Well, she hasn't given any commitment to do that, because she was asked about it. She said her grasp of the language, you know, at this point is sketchy, because like many of us, you may have been very good at it in school, but you don't get to use it through your adult life, and therefore, you know, your grasp on the language fades. But unlike Joe McHugh, who set his head down and said, right, I'm going to learn this and I'm going to learn it right, she's not giving any such guarantee.
Well, she's only a week,
but she could give the guarantee, Minister. I mean, in terms of, like, if I was a Gaelgor, I'm actually from the Gaeltacht area now, I'm not a Gaelgor at the moment. I would have been at one stage. But the message that's sending to me from central government, if you appoint a minister to the Ministry of the Gaeltacht and she's saying, I'm not going to bother getting proficient in the language, whatever amount of investment you want to make in the Gaeltacht, that sends a very strong message to me.
I thought you'd be saying, wasn't Joe McHugh's example a fantastic example?
Wasn't
of
it?
How,
and yet
how,
now, but has it been undone by Josepha? No, I think it was.
Joe, you know, Joe is still the line minister there. But now we have another minister who clearly is from the very first day out is speaking Irish as part of her talk about Creative Ireland, and she will build that capability over time. But I can understand people not committing to say, I'm going to be fluent in 6 months' time, and someone like yourself will come back, and if she's not there, you know, there will be all
it's
this
much more
and
than
cry.
That though. No, I'm not asking her to say that she'd be fluent in 6 months' time, but I mean, what, and Joe McHugh didn't say that. He just said he was going to put his head down and try and improve the language for himself, and she said, I'm not going to make any commitments to
but he's
do
been
that.
A fantastic example of what we should be encouraging. I mean, Irish shouldn't be seen as some sort of a reservation that you have to, you know, get your visa to show you're fit to enter. Irish should be part
even
of something.
Even for the minister, the cabinet minister.
Part of we should be encouraged. People who don't have high levels of Irish should be encouraged to use what they have. I think that's what we're trying to do. And you know, we have a very active young Fine Gael Irish speaking group who have set up their own drop-in centres who encourage speaking of Irish within the party. So you know, I think we're seeing a new and more mature attitude to growing the language. Like when I was at school, I did my 1500 hours of Irish like everyone else, but I haven't been able to retain it. Mm. I think the way we're now teaching it with the new emphasis in the junior cycle and in the oral, the emphasis on oral in primary, I think it will be retained. And I think we can't, you know, it can't be some sort of a cudgel to, you know, to beat people who don't have the competence. I think that won't encourage people. And I think the opposite, which Joe McHugh is a great example of someone who did it for the love of it.
Okay, so Joe McHugh is a great example. Is Josepha Madigan a great example?
Well, we'll wait and see how she gets along. But I think you know, taking a cudgel to people who get appointed to a post and say, you know, when will you be competent in the Irish language? I don't think that's a way to encourage people to participate.
Gurmagad, Minister for Education and Skills, Richard Bruton, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Sarah.
Between the Lines on News Talk.